Chapter 9. Malware. When I first started in computer security back in 1987, it was malicious programs, malware, that first caught my eye. The first computer viruses, for example, Apple's Elk Cloner and Pakistani Brain, were just showing up, although Trojans and worms had been around longer. Computer viruses were so unknown and almost rare that popular media pundits declared them to be hoaxes. That was until entire companies were taken down by them. And this was before the internet was the internet. Back then, computer malware spread via phone dial-up bulletin boards and hand-to-hand, as people copied each other's software, both legally and illegally. Malware is still one of the most popular hacking methods. Note: the first piece of malware I ever got hit by was an ANSI bomb. A victim had to have a driver called ANSI.sys loaded on their computer via the config.sys file. But this was a popular setup in the early days of IBM PC compatibles and the disk operating system, DOS. Malware types. The traditional types of malware are virus, worm, and Trojan horse. A computer virus is a self-replicating program that, when executed, goes around looking for other programs, or sometimes, as with macro viruses, data, to infect. A computer worm is a replicating program that doesn't usually modify other programs or data. It simply travels around on devices and networks using its own coded instructions, often exploiting one or more software vulnerabilities. A Trojan horse program masquerades as some other legitimate program that the device or user is tricked into executing. Today's malware is often a combination of two or more of these traditional types. For example, it may initially be spread as a Trojan to gain the initial foothold and then use its own code to replicate to spread further. Malware can be quite efficient. Thousands of different malware programs have successfully infected entire networks across the globe in hours. Hundreds of malware programs have infected a significant portion of the computers attached to the internet in a day. The speed record still belongs to the 2003 SQL Slammer Worm. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/sql_slammer, which infected most internet-accessible vulnerable SQL servers in around 10 minutes. The related patch had been out for 5 months, but back then, almost no one patched in a timely manner. Today, most malware programs are Trojans and require that an end user initiate an action, such as opening a web link or file attachment, to initiate the malware. Although the involved device or user may have had no hand in accidentally executing the program at all. It depends on the malware scenario and how it was spread. Number of malware programs. There are literally hundreds of millions of different malware programs on the planet today, and an immeasurable number of new ones being made each year. Most malware programs are slight, customized variants derived from just a few thousand different base malware programs. Still, each variant must be detected by anti-malware programs, which often use a combination of digital signatures, a unique set of bytes for each malware program or family of programs, and behavioral detection. An anti-malware program must be able to quickly scan tens of millions of files against hundreds of millions of malware programs and do it without significantly slowing down the device it is installed on. It's a tough thing to do, and even if done with the maximum degree of accuracy, it can be defeated by one new malware program with a single changed byte. Note: anti-malware programs are more often called antivirus programs, even though they detect and remove multiple malware classes, because most malware programs were computer viruses when the scanning type of program became very popular. Mostly criminal in origin. One of the biggest and most disturbing trends in malware is how it is mostly used for direct criminal purposes these days. Until around 2005, most malware was written by teenagers and young adults to prove that they could write computer malware. That it functioned and replicated was enough. Sure, there were a few malware programs that did intentionally cause direct harm, but most were more bothersome than dangerous. Now, almost all malware is created for direct criminal purposes. Most malware users are out to steal money one way or other, be it through direct financial gain, stolen identities, or stolen passwords. These days, ransomware, which is malware that encrypts your data and asks for money to decrypt it, is very popular. Other malware steals game resources or electronic currency, or makes unauthorized stock trades. Adware infiltrates your computer to force you to see advertisements, or specific advertisements, that you would otherwise not see, or covertly forces your computer to visit other targeted websites to increase the visitor hits to generate ill-gotten advertising revenue. Some malware is used to break in and steal confidential information. Other malware may be used to cause massive distributed denial-of-service attacks, covered in Chapter 28, DDoS attacks. Gone are the days when most malware was made by mischievous kids that printed cute little sayings on your screen, played Yankee Doodle Dandy on your speaker, or asked you to help legalize marijuana, such as the stoned boot virus. Today, malware has gone professional. Malware is often created by one person and bought and sold by others. Often, thousands of computers that are compromised by a particular malware program are collected together in what are called botnets. These botnets can be rented or purchased and then instructed to attack a particular site or perform an action across multiple locations. Many times, the malware that initially breaks into a particular computer is known as the downloader. It gets initial access and modifies the system to ensure the success of future malware or hacker ownership. Then it downloads a new malware program with new instructions. This process may be repeated up to dozens of times until the eventual program and instructions are downloaded and executed. In this way, most malware is kept up to date and invisible to the eyes of anti-malware products. Malware programs are even sold with 24/7 tech support and warranties against detection, and their developers are given customer satisfaction ratings by buyers. Malware is responsible for stealing or causing hundreds of millions of dollars of damage every year. Every old computer security person who has been fighting malware for longer than a decade wishes the only problem we had was dealing with mischievous kids. Defenses against malware. There are many defenses against malware exploitation, most of which are good against several other forms of hacking as well. Fully patched software. A fully patched system is far more difficult for malware to exploit than one that is not. These days, exploit kits are hosted on compromised websites, and when a user visits, the exploit kit will look for one or more unpatched vulnerabilities before attempting to trick the user into running a Trojan horse program. If the system is unpatched, often the malicious program can be secretly executed without the user being aware of anything. Training. A fully patched system is difficult for malware to compromise without involving the end user. In cases where the malware or exploit kit doesn't find an unpatched vulnerability, it will usually resort to some sort of social engineering trick. Usually, it involves telling the end user they need to run or open something in order to satisfy some beneficial outcome. Training users about common social engineering techniques is a great way to reduce the success of malware. Anti-malware software. Anti-malware, frequently referred to as antivirus software, is a necessity on almost every computer system. Even the best anti-malware software can miss a malware program, and no program is 100% perfect at blocking all malware. But running a computer system without such a program is like driving with leaky brakes. You may get away with it for a while, but eventually disaster will strike. At the same time, never believe any antivirus vendor's claim of 100% detection. That is always a lie. Application control programs. Application control programs, also known as whitelisting or blacklisting programs, are great at stopping malware when used in whitelisting mode. In whitelisting mode, only predefined and authorized programs are allowed to run. This stops most viruses, worms, and trojans. Application control programs can be operationally difficult to implement because, by their very nature, every program and executable must be pre-approved to run. And not every malware program type or hacker can be prevented, especially those that use built-in legitimate programs and scripting tools. That said, application control programs are an effective tool and are getting better all the time. Personally, I think for any system to be considered very secure, it must have an active and defined whitelisting program. Security boundaries. Firewalls and other types of local and network security boundaries, such as VLANs, routers, and so on, are good at keeping malware away from even being able to exploit a computer device. Most operating systems come with built-in local firewalls, but most are not configured and enabled by default. Implementing a firewall can significantly reduce malicious risk, especially if there is an unpatched vulnerability present. Firewalls are discussed in more detail in Chapter 17, Firewalls. Intrusion detection. Network intrusion detection / prevention, NID/P, and host intrusion detection prevention, HID/P, software, and devices can be used to recognize and stop malware on the network or local host. Intrusion detection is covered in Chapter 14. But like traditional anti-malware programs, NIDs and HIDs are not 100% reliable and should not be trusted alone to detect and stop malware. Malware has long been a part of computer security threats and will always remain a top threat. Back in the late 1990s, with the increasing sophistication of antivirus scanners, I was confident that malware programs would be a thing of the past by 2010. That was back when we had just hundreds of malware programs. Now, with hundreds of millions of distinct malware variants, I realize how overly hopeful and innocent I had been. Chapters 10 and 11 profile Susan Bradley and Mark Rasinovich, who have been successfully fighting malware for decades. Chapter 10. Profile. Susan Bradley. I met Susan Bradley over 15 years ago, when I was selected as one of Microsoft's early most valuable professionals. The Microsoft MVP, as it's known, is awarded to independent community leaders who show expertise in one or more Microsoft technologies and have broad interaction with end users, such as writing a regular blog, newsletter, or column. It was clear early on that Bradley was an MVP of MVPs. She is super smart, hardworking, and forever helping not just end users, but MVPs. We're end users, too. She was originally awarded her MVP in 2000 for Microsoft's now-discontinued Small Business Server, SBS, product, but she has broad and deeply technical Windows expertise. The annual MVP, mvp.microsoft.com/n-us/public-profile/7500?full-name=Susan%20Elise%20Bradley. She has continued to get continually every year since, is known as the Cloud and Data Center Management MVP. If you don't know what Small Business Server was, just take the majority of Microsoft's most major and complex products, including Active Directory, Exchange, SQL, Outlook, and so on, put them into one software install for small businesses, and claim it's easy. I made a lot of consulting money helping customers who quickly figured out it wasn't so easy. Bradley gave me technical support when I was stuck on a problem that I could not solve alone. We eventually met at some national computer security conferences we were both speaking at, and we bonded a bit because of our shared accounting background. We are both CPAs, although she is a partner in a CPA firm, whereas I can only spell CPA now. She has written contributing chapters to a few books, has her SANS Global Information Assurance Certification, GIAC certification, and is a co-author of the Windows Secrets newsletter, windowssecrets.com/. I asked Bradley how she got into computer security, and she said, "I started in an industry that by definition is concerned about money, privacy, and confidentiality, accounting. That foundation of ensuring that transactions we rely upon can be relied upon translates to computer security. We have to ensure what we type into the keyboard, or these days input via voice, data points, sensors, etc., retains its same information once it gets into whatever repository it was intended to be. I got into communicating to small businesses and others because of my own needs and initial confusion, initially around patching. I had a server product that was a kitchen sink of products, and all of those products had to be patched. There wasn't an easy way to do it. Back then, people didn't even patch their products. Then the SQL Slammer worm came out in 2003 and impacted the world. And the patch against it was out for a long time, something like 6 months. But patching wasn't easy. So I learned how to patch my kitchen sink of products and figured that other business owners would appreciate what I learned and how to do it. That started me down the road of what I have done ever since." Bradley continues to focus on small businesses, and I know from her postings and conversations that helping people avoid or recover from ransomware is something she is also very involved with. I asked her what she recommended for customers trying to avoid or recover from ransomware. She replied, "Over a few years, it became clear that ransomware was a big problem, not only for consumers, but small businesses. It can be difficult and overwhelming to find the right information, so a friend and fellow MVP, since 2006, Amy Babichak, and I got together 3 years ago and decided to make lemonade out of the lemons of ransomware. We created the Ransomware Prevention Kit, thirdtier.net/ransomware-prevention-kit/. It contains everything you need to know. It's a bundle of good information and tools, like group policy settings and scripts, and we are now adding videos to help people. It's not free. Pricing starts out at $25. Originally, all proceeds went to a women's scholarship fund. thirdtier.net/women-in-it-scholarship-program/. Amy's aunt loaned her the money to get her first computer certification, and Amy feels that she would not have been as successful today without that much-needed loan, so she's trying to pay it back. The scholarship fund will reimburse women for exam fees for successfully passed IT exams. Amy's original funding goal for the scholarship was $10,000, and she got that in 9 months. Today, a collected portion of the kit funds goes to the scholarship rather than 100%. It takes a tremendous amount of time to keep it refreshed and up to date. But Amy tries her best to make sure that as the kit gets updated, every buyer gets an updated copy, and that's a lot of work. I asked Bradley what she thought the biggest problem in computer security is. She replied, "We keep going down the same rabbit holes and not getting to root causes. Take, for example, how we are numb over data breaches these days. Because it doesn't harm the impacted business that much. It's acceptable risk to merely meet PCI, discussed in Chapter 37, Policy and Strategy, Standards, and Do What is Good Enough for the Checklist. But we're not stepping back and thinking how better to design the flow of the data to protect it. Part of the problem is that the technology is constantly changing, but the underlying problems aren't. Yesterday, eons ago, we were on mainframes. Then we got into PCs, servers, and networks, a distributed PC model. Back then, people and consultants just kept throwing up servers and not really concentrating enough on how to secure them. Today, we are moving to a cloud-centric model. Everyone is cloud-first. And I see some of the same underlying mistakes being made. People are moving their servers to the cloud or choosing cloud services to run some of their business, but not really understanding how to best secure it. We are making some of the same mistakes again, only it's getting harder because the customer doesn't always control the security and the forensic trail is moving farther away. Sometimes it feels like we really haven't solved anything. We need to focus more on the underlying problems because the technology is always changing. If you want to master or manage Microsoft Windows, anything Susan Bradley writes should be a must-read for you. For more information on Susan Bradley, for more information about Susan Bradley, check out these resources. Susan Bradley's Microsoft MVP blog. blogs.msmvps.com/Bradley/ Susan Bradley at Windows Secrets. windowssecrets.com/author/Susan-Bradley/ Chapter 11. Profile. Mark Rasinovich. No one knows everything about Microsoft Windows. It's tens of millions of lines of code. But for more than two decades, Mark Rasinovich has come close. He's the Chief Technology Officer of Microsoft Azure. C-level officers, CEOs, CIOs, and so on, of companies are rarely people that still grok technology at the deepest levels. But Rasinovich does. Rarely is there a smarter person in the room or someone who knows more about a feature. He's very happy to be looking at code. I told him this during our interview, and he replied, "The details of the technology is what keeps me going." I've known Rasinovich for nearly two decades. For a long time, he ran two software companies, Winternals, a for-profit commercial company, and Sysinternals, a not-for-profit freeware company. Both the companies and their software were very popular with techies. Eventually, Microsoft acquired both companies when he went to work for them. Visit sysinternals.com to see the cool utilities he created and Microsoft still offers and updates today. Rasinovich has always been a techie's techie, and he is not afraid of controversy when finding the truth during his technical investigations. I even distinctly remember being with him at a restaurant dinner table back in 2005. Neither of us were Microsoft employees at the time, when the news of his Sony BMG rootkit scandal discovery went viral. Rasinovich had discovered that when a Sony music CD was placed inside of a computer running Windows, it secretly installed two pieces of software to help Sony implement Digital Rights Management, DRM. The software could not be easily uninstalled, and parts of it would install even if the user didn't accept Sony's Software Installation End User License Agreement, EULA, terms. It interfered with Windows' built-in CD operations, and to make matters worse, Sony's software contained vulnerabilities, which malware eventually took advantage of. Rasinovich was testing out his rootkit finding program, Rootkit Revealer, when he stumbled across the Sony program. A rootkit modifies the operations of the underlying operating system to better hide. He likened what Sony's DRM program was doing to what would otherwise be considered a malware rootkit by any standard definition, which was a very remarkable claim at the time. He was calling out a huge legitimate company for doing something that many would consider unethical. His original blog post can be found here. blogs.technet.microsoft.com/markrasinovich/2005/10/31/sony-rootkits-and-digital-rights-management-gone-too-far/. The media was all over the story, and it garnered Sony much negative publicity. At first, Sony tried to claim what it was doing was normal and acceptable, but after days of public outcry, Sony was forced to admit that it did wrong, and they offered an uninstall program. They eventually recalled the related CDs and offered compensation. Unfortunately, they even badly bungled both the response and the uninstaller. Class action lawsuits followed along with government investigations. You can read about the entire scandal here. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/sony_bmg_copy_protection_root-kit_scandal. Because of Rasinovich's work and the resulting public outcry, every vendor since has been warned, and secretly installing software from otherwise legitimate software has been minimized. And that's just one of the many things Rasinovich has done. He frequently teaches or presents highly technical educational sessions at conferences. Those of us who compete against him to see who can get the highest presenter scores, as ranked by audience members, know that coming in second place is the best we can do when he is on the conference schedule. He has written or co-written many books. Amazon.com/mark-e.rasinovich/e/B001IGNICC/, including a best-selling cybersecurity thriller. The fact that those cyber Armageddon stories contain things that actually can and sometimes do happen makes them as scary as any Stephen King novel. He earned a Ph.D. in computer engineering from Carnegie Mellon University in 1994, and he joined Microsoft in 1996. Rasinovich is now one of the most important people in Microsoft, leading the way on many of Microsoft's biggest technology pushes. He was instrumental in speeding up and securing Microsoft's most recent operating systems, and he is now the point man in charge of Microsoft's cloud. Besides being the Microsoft Azure CTO, he is a Microsoft Technical Fellow, which is only awarded to people who have had a significant impact on Microsoft and the world in general. The irony is not lost on Rasinovich, because 2 decades ago in 1997, Microsoft almost got him fired from the company he was working for at the time. Rasinovich, employed by Open Systems Resources, was working on software for Windows NT 3.51. In the process of learning more about Windows internals, he discovered that a single registry edit controlled whether Windows NT would function as a server versus a workstation. He clarified, it was actually 2 registry entries, one called product type, and another encoded one that was used to detect tampering with the first one. The registry entry changed 12 other system parameters, which basically turned Windows into server or workstation focused. And I wrote an article, WindowsITPro.com/systems-management/inside-windows-nt-registry, on it in Windows IT Pro magazine. An article recapping the finding is here. archive.oreilly.com/pub/a/oreilly/news/differences_nt.html. I remember the article well. I was just beginning to write professionally myself at the same level, and I was asked to be a technical editor on the article by one of the magazine's editors. Even then, before its publication, everyone understood that Microsoft was likely to be unhappy because they were selling Windows NT Workstation and Windows NT Server as 2 completely different but similar products, with the latter version having a significantly higher price tag. I remember hearing that Rasinovich had been fired because of the article being published. I asked him if it was true, that Microsoft got him fired because of the article. He replied, "Well, they certainly were not happy, but they didn't get me fired. They did apply some pressure to Open Systems Resources, and that pressure did lead me to leaving OSR. I went to IBM Research from there, but I always had friends and a mostly friendly relationship with many people at Microsoft. I was still invited to present about Microsoft Windows internals, and I was writing my Windows internals books. I was eventually invited several times to work at Microsoft. They acquired me along with Winternals and Sysinternals, which were 85-employee companies at the time. The rest is history." Today, Rasinovich helps develop Microsoft Azure's technology direction, making it more feature-rich, faster, and more secure. He has been working with containers and microservices a lot lately. Containers are a virtual machine paradigm popularized by Docker, docker.com/. Containers came out of nowhere, and some were worried that they might threaten the virtual machine big boys, such as Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and VMware. Instead, led by Rasinovich, Microsoft adopted containers, and Azure now runs one of the largest container shops in the world. I asked him whether containers helped or hurt computer security. He said, "It depends on what you call a container and the container scenario. It may make computer security slightly easier in some instances. Containers are effectively stateless, which makes it harder for an attacker to get a foothold if all their hard work can be easily wiped out. But at the same time, if the vulnerability that allowed them to get in once is still there, they can just get back in, or maybe the first time allowed them to access the non-stateless backend, like the SQL server. And so a reset container isn't going to stop them. One of the downsides of containers, especially as Docker imagines them, is layers among layers of containers to create a single application or service. And if you have to patch or update the code on one Docker image, there may be dependencies that require that all the related images get rebuilt. It becomes a squared explosion of things to patch, fix, or rebuild. That's one of the bad things, more complexity. To end our interview, I asked Rasinovich what he would recommend to anyone considering a computer security career. His answer basically mimicked his own career and success. He recommended, "You need to understand at an expert level all the systems you are going to defend, how they interact, and everything there, including identity, policy, monitoring, and network segmentation. Step one is to become deeply familiar with the software or platform itself. Second, make sure you look for and get different viewpoints. Each viewpoint has slightly different versions of the same thing. And by searching for and understanding the different viewpoints, you can better learn what you will be trying to protect." For more on Mark Rasinovich. For more information about Mark Rasinovich, check out these resources. Mark Rasinovich's Wikipedia entry. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/Mark_Rasinovich. Mark Rasinovich's books. Amazon.com/Mark-E.Rasinovich/E/B001IGNICC/. Mark Rasinovich's website. TrojanHorseTheBook.com/. Mark Rasinovich on Twitter. @MarkRasinovich. Mark Rasinovich's Microsoft blog. blogs.technet.microsoft.com/Mark Rasinovich/. Mark Rasinovich's cool Sysinternals utilities. Sysinternals.com. Chapter 12. Cryptography. Much of the underlying technology that makes the rest of computer security work involves cryptography. Cryptography has been around for eons, and it will be around long after we leave planet Earth for other hospitable planets. Personally, cryptography is the computer security genre that I love the most. Even though after nearly 3 decades of being a crypto hobbyist, I don't consider myself a cryptography expert. What is cryptography? In the digital world, cryptography is the use of a series of binary ones and zeros to encrypt or verify other digital content. Cryptography involves using mathematical formulas called ciphers, along with those ones and zeros called cryptographic keys, to prevent unauthorized people from seeing private content or to prove the identity or validity of another person or some unadulterated content. The simplest encryption example I can think of is where some plain text, non-encrypted content, is converted to an encrypted representation by moving the alphabet of each involved character by one place. For example, A becomes B, B becomes C, C becomes D, and so on, until Z becomes A. Thus, the word frog would become GSPH. The decryptor could reverse the process to reveal the original plain text content. In this example, the cipher, it's almost silly to call it one, is the math, which in this case is plus or minus, addition or subtraction, and the key is 1. As simple as this example is, hundreds of years of secret messages and cereal box decoder rings have used it, although they were not always successful at keeping the message secret from unintended readers. In today's digital world, cryptographic keys are usually at least 128 bits, 128 ones or zeros long, if not longer. Depending on the cipher, a key may be longer, although if the math is resistant to cipher attacks, usually the longest key sizes are 4,096 bits. If you see longer key sizes, that is usually indicative of weak math or someone who does not know cryptography very well or is trying to sell snake oil to people who do not know it very well. Why can't attackers just guess all the possible keys? People new to cryptography don't understand why attackers can't simply try all the possible key 1 and 0 combinations that can result from a particular key size. Couldn't someone with a very fast computer guess all the possible combinations? In short, no. Even a modern key size of 2,000 bits is resistant against brute force guessing. Not only isn't any single computer powerful enough, but if you took every computer in the world, not only today but for the foreseeable future, there wouldn't be enough power. This is at least true until quantum cryptography becomes real one day. Hence, all pure cryptographic breaks rely on hints in the content or weaknesses in the math. Cryptographic math is tricky, to say the least, to get right. And what might initially look like undefeatable math is often found to be full of flaws that allow significantly fast breaking. That's why encryption standards and key sizes change all the time, as old ciphers get weakened and new, more resistant ciphers emerge. Symmetric versus asymmetric keys. If the encryption key that is used to encrypt something is the same as what is used to decrypt it later on, such as in our simple example earlier, the 1, then the key is called symmetric. If the key used to encrypt something is different than what is used to decrypt it, it's called asymmetric. Asymmetric ciphers are also known as public key encryption, where one party has the private key that only they know, but everyone else can have the public key, and as long as no one else knows the private key, it all works securely. However, symmetric encryption is usually faster and stronger for a stated key size. Popular cryptography. These days, many encryption ciphers are well known and tested to become industry, if not worldwide, standards. Popular symmetric encryption keys include Data Encryption Standard, DES, 3DES, DDES, and Advanced Encryption Standard, AES. The first two examples are early examples and are no longer used. The latter, AES, is considered strong and is the most popular symmetric cipher used today. Symmetric key sizes usually range from 128 bits to 256 bits, but they gain length over time. Every single bit increase, say from 128 bits to 129 bits, usually doubles the strength of the key within the same cipher. Popular asymmetric ciphers include Diffie-Hellman, the Hellman in Diffie-Hellman is profiled in the next chapter, Rivest-Shamir-Adelman, RSA, and elliptical curve cryptography, ECC. ECC is the new kid on the block and just starting to be used. Asymmetric key sizes typically range from 1,024 bits to 4,096 bits, although 2,048 bits is considered the bare minimum for Diffie-Hellman and RSA today. ECC uses smaller key sizes, starting at 256 bits. 384 bits is considered sufficiently strong today. In general, asymmetric ciphers are used to securely transmit symmetric keys, which do the majority of the encryption between a source and destination. Hashes. Cryptography is also used for verifying identities and content. Both instances use cipher algorithms known as cryptographic hashes. With this approach, the plaintext content to be verified is mathematically applied to a key, again just a series of ones and zeros, to get a unique output, called the hash result or hash. An identity or content can be hashed at any point in time and be rehashed again, and the two hashes can be compared to confirm that the hashed content has not changed since its original hashing. Common hashes are Secure Hash Algorithm 1, SHA-1, SHA-2, and SHA-3. SHA-1 was found to have some cryptographic weaknesses, also shared with SHA-2, and so SHA-1 is being retired. SHA-2 is becoming the most popular hash, but cipher experts are already recommending that SHA-3 be used. Most cryptographic solutions use symmetric, asymmetric, and hashing algorithms to produce the desired protection. Many countries, like the U.S., have a standards body that analyzes and approves various ciphers for government use. The officially approved ciphers often become used around the world. In the U.S., the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST.gov, in conjunction with the National Security Agency, NSA.gov, have public contests in which cryptographers around the world are invited to submit their own ciphers for analysis and selection. It's conducted in a fairly public way, and often even the losers agree on the final selections. Unfortunately, the NSA and NIST have also been accused at least twice of intentionally weakening official standards, particularly with DES and dual EC-DRBG, dual elliptic curve deterministic random bit generator, the latter of which has a backdoor. This has created tension, and many people no longer trust what NIST and NSA declare as good cryptography. Cryptographic uses. Cryptography underlies much of our online digital world. Cryptography protects our passwords and biometric identities, and it is used in digital certificates. Cryptography is used every time we log on to our computer and connect to an HTTPS-protected website. It is used to verify downloaded software, to secure email, and verify computers to each other. Encryption is used to protect hard drives and portable media against unauthorized viewing, to prevent OS boot sector corruption, and to protect wireless networks. It is used to sign programming scripts and documents. It allows us to have private connections over the public internet to our companies and computers, and it is behind almost all credit card and financial transactions in the world. Good cryptography is the enemy of spies, tyrants, and authoritarian regimes. It is not hyperbole to say that without cryptography, the internet would not be the internet, and our computers would not ever be under our control. Cryptographic attacks. There are a host of cryptographic attacks. The following sections will explore a few of the more prominent ones. Math attacks. Many attacks are simply theoretical attacks that find mathematical weaknesses. Without a mathematical weakness, a given cipher can usually withstand a brute force attack equal to the number of bits in the key minus 1. Thus, a 128-bit cipher, 2 to the 128th power, like SHA-1, should be capable of withstanding 2 to the 127th power guesses on average before it falls. Attackers have now successfully weakened SHA-1, using math to find and prove math flaws, to something like 2 to the 57th power bits. Although 2 to the 127th power is considered unbreakable, at least now, 2 to the 57th power is considered either breakable today or going to be readily breakable in the near future without a hacker needing to use a tremendous amount of computing power. Known ciphertext / plaintext. Many attacks are successful because they have a hint, also known as a crib. The crib is usually in the form of a known set of bits or bytes, in either the ciphertext, plaintext content, or private key. A crib has the effect of shortening the possible number of bits in the protective cipher key. Side-channel attacks. Side-channel attacks often attack an unforeseen implementation artifact to be able to more easily determine the secret keys. A common example is when a computer CPU changes its sound or magnetic frequency wave when processing a 0 versus a 1. Thus, someone with a very sensitive listening device might be able to determine what zeros and ones a computer is processing when accessing a private key. Another related example is an attacker being able to determine which keyboard keys you are typing simply because they record the sound of you typing. Insecure implementations. The vast majority of successful attacks against cryptography in the real world do not attack the cipher's math or keys. Instead, attackers find implementation flaws that are the equivalent of placing a locked door's key under the doormat. Even strong math cannot save a weak implementation. There are many other types of cryptographic attacks, although those listed earlier are the most common methods. The only defense against cryptographic attacks is good proven math, secure implementations, and invisible or easy-to-understand end-user interfaces. Nothing else matters. Chapter 3 profiled Bruce Schneier, who is considered the father of modern computer cryptography. Chapter 13 covers one of the most famous cryptographic co-founders in the world, Martin Hellman. And Chapter 15 focuses on Dr. Dorothy E. Denning, who wrote one of the first books on computer cryptography. Chapter 13. Profile. Martin Hellman. One of the things I've learned when talking to the best people in a particular field is that they tend to be good at multiple things. They aren't just good at the thing for which they are known. They usually have intense hobbies they are obsessed with and are trying to hack a lot of problems, many of which have nothing to do with why they are famous. Martin Hellman, one of the original creators of public key cryptography, is a great example. While still being one of the world's best cryptographers and thinking about how to solve the latest cryptography problems, he's also a guy who likes to soar gliders, improve marriages, and stop nuclear wars, not necessarily in that order. Hellman is famous for being the co-inventor of public key cryptography in 1976, along with his colleagues Whitfield Diffie and Ralph Merkle. The November 1976 paper that publicly announced everything to the world was called New Directions in Cryptography, ee.stanford.edu/Hellman/publications/24.pdf. The resulting cipher algorithm became known as Diffie-Hellman Key Exchange, but Hellman prefers to call it Diffie-Hellman-Merkle, and did so during our interview. About a year after New Directions in Cryptography, building upon Diffie and Hellman's previous work, Ron Rivest, Adi Shamir, and Leonard Adelman, all of MIT, created the RSA algorithm. And with their subsequent company's marketing efforts, public key cryptography took the world by storm, forever encasing all their names for posterity. I've been telling the story of how Hellman and his colleagues invented public key cryptography for a long time, without ever really being sure if my version was accurate. It's an incredible tale of three people, none of whom had formal cryptography training, discouraged by nearly everyone they met along the way other than themselves. In my version of the story, before corrections, I told of how Diffie had given an informal brown bag talk at IBM about public cryptography and persuaded no one. On their way out the door, one of the last people told Diffie about another crazy guy named Hellman with similar ideas. Diffie dropped what he was doing, drove across the country, and met with Hellman, who was at first put off by a stranger who had driven across the country to meet him, but quickly realized they had similar ideas, and they formed a partnership that made history. I asked Hellman how close my story was to being the truth as opposed to a myth. He replied, "When I first met Witt, I was entranced, not off-put. Here's what happened. I had worked at IBM years before Diffie showed up, but had left to go to MIT and then Stanford. I came back in 1974 and gave a talk about the problems with current cryptography. At the time at IBM, they weren't very interested. Although I didn't know it at the time, they had just invented what became the symmetric DES cipher and couldn't break it. IBM's management felt they had solved all the cryptographic problems, and it was time they moved on. Witt, unknown to me, came to IBM a few months later in 1974, and gave a similar talk with a similar outcome, with one exception. Alan Conheim, who headed the math department, told him to contact me when he returned to the San Francisco Bay Area. Witt was already going around the country talking to cryptographers, including David Kahn, the author of the popular crypto book The Codebreakers, amazon.com/codebreakers-comprehensive-history-communication-internet/dp/0684-831309. When Witt got back to the Bay Area, he called me and we set up a meeting. Far from being off-put by him, what was supposed to be a 30 to 60 minute meeting turned into hours, and I even invited him and his wife home with me to continue our conversation and meet my family. We talked until 11 p.m. that night. That was the fall of 1974. Prior to meeting Witt, all my other colleagues were discouraging me from working in cryptography. They told me that NSA had a huge budget and a several decades head start. How could I hope to discover something they didn't already know? And they continued, if I did anything good, they would classify it. Both arguments were valid. But given the awards we've won, it was very wise to do something that seemed foolish. While I might have persevered in spite of all that discouragement, meeting Witt gave me a real boost. Plus, we worked really well together for the next few years, including on public key cryptography. I asked Hellman who invented what out of the partnership. We know that Merkel, working in isolation as a student at Berkeley, independently came up with half of the idea for public key encryption, exchanging a key over an insecure channel with no prearrangement. But what did Hellman do as opposed to Diffie? He replied, "I don't like to split up work effort or success. We were working on it together, talking and sharing, but Diffie definitely first stated the idea of a public key crypto system. We had already come up with the idea of a trapdoor crypto system, where a cipher has a built-in weakness, i.e. the trapdoor, that only people given some information about the trapdoor can utilize. Diffie went further and conceptualized about what it would take to make that happen, public key cryptography, and specifically about how to do it with what is now called a public key crypto system, which can do both public key exchange and digital signatures. He did that in 1975. Later on, we learned that Merkel had, independent of us, also thought of public key exchange, but we didn't know it at the time. I came up with the mathematical implementation of that idea in 1976. What is now often called Diffie-Hellman key exchange And because it was closer to Merkel's idea than ours, I've argued it should be called Diffie-Hellman-Merkel Key Exchange. I'm right now sitting at the same desk where I came up with the algorithm back then, in the wee hours of the night in May 1976. I asked how RSA came about. He said, I had given a talk at MIT and Ron Rivest and I had been corresponding with each other. Shortly before what became known as the RSA system came out publicly, he sent me a draft. When I saw it, my first reaction was, we missed it. They had figured out how to use large prime numbers to make factoring work as a public key crypto system. Diffie-Hellman-Merkel used large prime numbers, but not factoring. A paper I'd written with my student Steve Polig a few years earlier included RSA as a variant, but we hadn't yet thought of public key cryptography, so we missed that. I asked Hellman how he felt with RSA taking off and making millions for its creators, with his team's own contribution hardly making any money for its inventors. He said, people over the years ask me how I felt about it, with RSA coming so soon after our discovery. Their paper credited Diffie and me with inventing public key cryptography. But their company, RSA Data Security, refused to pay royalties. My feelings have changed over time. Initially, I felt like RSA hadn't adequately highlighted the connection between their work and mine with Steve Polig. But over time, I came to see it differently. RSA did such a brilliant job of marketing public key crypto that they created an entirely new industry. I got recognition and opportunities that might have never come my way if RSA had never happened. I see it quite differently now, and I'm thankful. I'm good friends with Ron Rivest to this day. In fact, I tried to call him about something just before this interview. I wondered how much Hellman is still into cryptography these days. I asked him if he thought quantum cryptography would ever happen. He said, are you referring to quantum cryptography or quantum computing? Because those are two very different things. Quantum crypto is the ability to securely transmit keys or information using quantum properties. In contrast, quantum-based computers could break all the currently used public key systems. I'm not sure when it will happen or even if. It seems like nuclear fusion, 20 years off for the last 50 years. But it may happen one day, and I have some possible solutions. We need to encrypt and sign things with two methods so that if one method is broken, the other still protects. For example, we've got public key cryptography and key distribution centers, as are used in PGP applications. People should encrypt their keys with both so that if quantum computing breaks public key crypto, the KDC portion still holds. Or sign a document using traditional public key signatures, and also use Merkle tree signatures. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/Merkle_signature_scheme. If you're serious about cryptography and you're worried that what you are using may be broken in the future, then run a dual backup system. The NSA has a phrase for this: belts and suspenders. If you use both, you'll never be caught with your pants down, even if one fails. I guess that answered my question. The last bit of our conversation focused on nuclear deterrence and improving your marriage. Hellman and his wife wrote a great book, amazon.com/new-map-relationships-creating-planet/dp/09974923009/, that figures into both areas. He had sent me a copy to review before our interview, and to be honest, I was sort of cringing at the idea of one of my cryptography heroes trying to get me off subject. Then I read it. It's great. I bought a copy for each of my married children. Hellman somehow intertwines a lot of his cryptography history and frustrations into a book about improving relationships and avoiding nuclear devastation. In 2015, Hellman and Diffie won the ACM's AM Turing Award. amturing.acm.org/award_winners/Hellman_4055781.cfm, which is basically seen as computer science's version of the Nobel Prize. Hellman and his wife are using their $500,000 prize portion to reduce the risk of a disaster involving nuclear weapons, a threat that is gaining new interest since the 2016 election. Bravo! For more information on Martin Hellman. For more information about Martin Hellman, check out these resources. A New Map for Relationships, Creating True Love at Home and Peace on the Planet. amazon.com/new-map-relationships-creating-planet/dp/09974923009/. Martin Hellman's Stanford Bio. www.ee.stanford.edu/Hellman/. Martin Hellman's work on cryptography. www.ee.stanford.edu/Hellman/crypto.html. Chapter 14. Intrusion Detection /APTs. Intrusion detection is the art of detecting unauthorized activity. In the computer world, it means detecting unauthorized connections, logons, and resource accesses, or attempts at the same. Intrusion detection is part of the reason why nearly every computer device has an event logging system. The two have been forever linked since James P. Anderson's groundbreaking 1980 paper called Computer Security Threat Monitoring and Surveillance. csrc.nist.gov/publications/history/ande80.pdf. While computer systems have been good at generating lots of events, humans and their evaluating alert systems haven't been so good at making sense of them. To most computer users, event log files are full of thousands of events that muddy up any chance for true maliciousness to be detected. The best report on the gap between badness entering a system and being detected is captured in Verizon's annual Data Breach Investigations Report. VerizonEnterprise.com/Verizon-Insights-Lab/DBIR/. The 2016 report, VerizonEnterprise.com/Verizon-Insights-Lab/DBIR/2016/, showed the following disturbing long-term trends. The average time from an initial compromise by a hacker to the exfiltration of private data or logon credentials is usually measured in minutes to a few days. Most attackers, 70% to 80%, are in the system for long periods of time, months before discovery. Discovery of a breach by internal resources only happens about 10% of the time. This is despite the evidence that most breaches are in the event logs and would have likely been detected if only the logs were looked at or managed correctly. To be clear, I'm talking about computer system event logs, and also the log files of computer security defense devices, e.g. firewalls, intrusion detection systems, and so on. Traits of a good security event message. Unfortunately, most computer security defenses generate thousands, if not billions, of event log messages that do not indicate maliciousness. Or if they do indicate actual maliciousness, they document an event that has very, very low risk to an environment, like when a firewall logs a blocked packet. The end result is that most security event logs are very noisy, meaning full of more useless information than useful. With that in mind, a good computer security event message should have these traits: low noise, low false positives and low false negatives, meaning that an occurrence likely indicates true maliciousness; readily understood description of event; as much surrounding detail as can be captured and useful to investigators. Generation of the event always triggers an incident response investigation. These traits are the holy grail of intrusion detection. Advanced Persistent Threats, APTs. Advanced Persistent Threats, APTs, attacks are conducted by professional criminal groups and have been responsible for compromising a large majority of businesses, military systems, and other entities over the last decade. In fact, most security experts believe that all internet-connected entities have been successfully compromised by APTs, or at the very least, could easily at will be compromised by an APT. APTs are run by full-time professional hackers who are different from traditional hackers in the following ways. They intend to remain permanently engaged after the initial compromise. They do not run when discovered. They have dozens to hundreds of compromises and exploits they can use, including 0 days. They always get total ownership of environment. Their objective is often stealing victims' intellectual property, IP, over the long term. Their origination is often a safe harbor country that will never prosecute them for their activities. Indeed, they are often state-sponsored and celebrated. The reason why APTs are covered in this chapter is that they are more difficult to detect using traditional intrusion detection. Not impossible, just difficult, without preparing and adjusting traditional intrusion detection methods. Some of the newer methods covered in this chapter are becoming quite accurate at detecting and preventing APTs. Types of intrusion detection. There are two basic types of intrusion detection, behavior-based and signature-based. Many intrusion detection systems are a combination of both methods. Behavior-based. Also known as anomaly detection, behavior-based intrusion detection looks for behaviors that indicate maliciousness. For example, a file trying to copy itself into another file. For example, computer virus. A program trying to perfidiously redirect a browser away from its user-intended URL. For example, adware. A MITM attack, and so on. An unexpected connection to a honeypot, or a person copying all the contents of an authentication database. For example, credential theft. The basic idea behind behavior detection is that there are too many bad things to individually identify, so look for their malicious behavior instead. It makes great sense. For example, there are tens of millions of computer viruses, most of which could be detected by looking for a single behavior of writing itself to a new host file. Dr. Dorothy E. Denning, profiled in Chapter 15, is a big proponent of intrusion detection systems, IDSs, and wrote her landmark paper on anomaly detection. users.ece.cmu.edu/tilde-adrian/731-sp04/ readings/denning-ids.pdf in 1986. Signature-based. Signature-based intrusion detection systems take the opposite approach. They believe that malicious behaviors change too often or that legitimate programs can create too many false positive indications to be reliable. Antivirus scanners are the perfect example of signature-based programs. They contain millions of unique bytes, signatures, which, if detected, will indicate maliciousness. Intrusion detection tools and services. In a general sense, any computer defense hardware or software that looks for and indicates maliciousness is an intrusion detection program. This includes firewalls, honeypots, anti-malware programs, and general event log management systems. Some experts only like to include solutions with intrusion detection in their name. Intrusion detection / prevention systems. Intrusion detection systems, IDSs, are purposefully built to detect maliciousness, Many IDSs come with IPS preventative mitigations, so the term IDS can easily mean IPS as well. Few hold to the strict definition. Some defenders are hesitant to activate automatic preventative mitigations, even if they are available, because of the frequent false positives many IDSs/IPSs have. Other times, for lower-risk IPS systems like anti-malware solutions, defenders want the automatic prevention enabled. An IDS/IPS is further classified as being a host-based IDS/IPS, HIDS/HIPS, or a network-based IDS/IPS, NIDS/NIPS, depending on whether the defense protects an individual host system or analyzes packets running across the network for maliciousness. The first widely popular HIDS I remember was Tripwire, n.wikipedia.org/wiki/tripwire_company_, back in 1992. It was co-founded by a Purdue University student, Gene Kim, and his professor, Dr. Eugene Spafford. It's not coincidental that Purdue University is also where Dr. Dorothy Denning went and taught. The first super popular NIDS I remember was open source Snort, snort.org/. I was lucky enough to get taught how to use it by its inventor, Martin Resch, at a SAN Institute class back in the early 1990s. It is now also a very popular commercial product, with both the open source and commercial versions developed by SourceFire. Event Log Management Systems. Behind every successful intrusion detection or event log solution is a system that detects and collects events from one or more sensors. In any enterprise with more than a few computer devices, it becomes essential to collect and analyze these events as a whole to get the best benefit. Event log management systems are responsible for collecting these events, analyzing them, and generating alerts. How well and accurately these systems do their job determines the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of the overall system. There are a lot of components and considerations to any event log management system. NIST's Special Publication 800-92, Guide to Computer Security Log Management, csrc.nist.gov/publications/NIST/pubs/800-92/sp800-92.pdf, is considered the definitive guide on effective event log management. Good event log management is hard and resource-intensive. Accordingly, there are many commercial vendors willing to do all the hard work for you. These are known as Security Information and Event Management, SEIM, companies or services. Detecting Advanced Persistent Threats, APTs. Professional APT hackers are very skilled at infiltrating a company with a minimum of maliciously detected activity. For many years, it was considered difficult, if not impossible, to detect them. But the field of intrusion detection eventually rose up to the challenge, and now there are several products, services, and companies that are very good at detecting APTs and APT-like activities. Operating system vendors are building in features and services that are significantly better at detecting these sorts of online criminals. Examples of this are Microsoft's Advanced Persistent Threat, microsoft.com/n-us/cloud-platform/advanced-threat-analytics, and Advanced Threat Protection, microsoft.com/n-us/windows-for-business/windows-atp/services. Many companies now routinely follow dozens of different APT groups, readily detecting where they go and what they are doing. Many companies offer services that can quickly detect APTs in your environment and alert you to their presence. Probably the biggest difference between traditional intrusion detection and the newer forms is the ability of the data to be collated across many, many companies distributed across the Internet. Some of the names in this space are CrowdStrike, CrowdStrike.com, AlienVault, AlienVault.com, and longtime anti-malware player Trend Micro, TrendMicro.com. It's clear that it's starting to get harder for malicious hackers to hide. The next chapter, Chapter 15, profiles early intrusion detection pioneer Dr. Dorothy E. Denning. Chapter 16 profiles Michael Dubinsky, a product manager of one of the more advanced intrusion detection services available today.